Governor Tim Pawlenty. It is great to be in your state for our 20th celebration, our 20th year, 20 and 20, 20%. It's great to be here and to celebrate this with you. As such a strong leader for us, a man who's worked with us very close and continues to try to come up with new things, it also gives me a great pleasure today to present to Governor Pawlenty the ACE President's Award.
Good afternoon, and thank you so much for the opportunity to come by and be part of this tremendous event sponsored by ACE, and thank you for the kind comments, Mr. President, and for the introduction. I appreciate it, and we are glad that you are here in Minnesota, the renewable energy capital of the United States, and certainly the ethanol capital of the United States, and I'll say more about that in just a minute, but I want to tell you that one of the advantages of being governor of the state of Minnesota is you get to hear some tremendous stories now and see some incredible things. You all know from the national news we've had a great deal of heartache and heartbreak here in Minnesota this last week as we saw a bridge collapse and what that meant in terms of loss of life and missing people and the need to go through a recovery process and the beginning of a rebuilding process. And our thoughts and prayers continue to be with those individuals and the people who have families missing, and we're doing all we can to make sure that situation gets addressed. But I also want to just share with you an unrelated story that I heard about. It's not necessarily fully true, but it's a story about the three nuns who were working hard at a charitable hospital, and they were working each day, each night, shifts that were long and hard, and they were going back from the hospital one night back to the convent where they lived as nuns. And they got to visiting on their way back, and they weren't noticing the fuel gauge on the car, and they ran out of fuel. And so the two younger nuns, who didn't have much experience, were quite anxious and nervous about this situation. And they jumped out of the car, and they were saying, you know, it's dark, we're out on a two-lane road, it's remote, there aren't people around, what are we going to do? And of course, the senior nun, Mother Superior, tried to calm them down and said, oh, sisters, ye of little faith. You know, there was a gas station just a mile back down the road. We'll simply walk back. We'll get some fuel, E85. We'll get some fuel, and we'll refuel the car, and all will be well. And the two younger nuns said, well, sister, that will not work. I mean, we don't have anything to carry the gas with. We have no containers. We have nothing. And she said, oh, God will provide. And she flipped open the trunk. And there are three bedpans left over from their tour of duty at the hospital. And so she said, we'll each take one of these bedpans and we'll go and we'll use them as canisters and we'll get the fuel. So they dutifully walk back to the gas station. They each carefully fill up their bedpans with gasoline blended with E85. And they carefully walk back to the car a mile without anybody even spilling a drop of this fuel. And as they get to the disabled car, they begin to each in turn pour gasoline from the bedpans into their vehicle. And as this is happening, a local Lutheran pastor happens to drive by. And at first, he's confused at the sight of bedpans being tilted up. And he rolls down his window. And a light goes on in his head. He now thinks he's figured this out. And he says, hallelujah, sisters. I thought I had faith. I just share that story with you because we welcome you to Minnesota, but we believe that a good portion of the ethanol, not industry, but movement, began in this state. It was pioneered by some of our farmers and some of our producers. They had, of course, a different economic outlook in the 1980s, and so building up that in the 70s as well. But we had people who had a vision for a different energy future for our country. And they were pioneers, and they were adventurers, and they were inventors, and they were people who had faith in this vision. And so we always start these discussions in Minnesota by thanking them, because all that we have in Minnesota, and I think in large part nationally, is because they had the courage, the vision, the appetite for risk, the passion, the advocacy to get out and not only cast the vision, but to sell it and bring others on board. And in 1986, Minnesota had a 20-cent producer payment. In 1992, we were the first state in the nation to put a mandate that at least 10% of our gasoline be comprised of ethanol. We passed in 2005 a proposal I made that was referenced in the introduction to take that up to 20% by 2012, that all of our fuel on average has to have be 20% ethanol, and if it doesn't, a 20% mandate kicks in. And we're working with the EPA to get that approved through testing, and ACE has been incredible. You ask about the value of the membership, the value of this organization. One of many examples is pulling alongside saying, yeah, we support higher blends, whether it's through the blended pump or whether it's through higher levels of mandates like I've described. We've got the highest level of per capita ethanol use in the country here in Minnesota, the most D85 pumps at about 320 by a long shot, by the way. And we just passed some legislation in Minnesota to increase that even further, and we think there'll be some help from the federal legislation as well. We currently produce about 620 million gallons of ethanol in Minnesota, but we're going to get that up over a billion by 2008. And so while other states now see the wisdom of our public policies in Minnesota, we want to continue to hold ourselves out as the benchmark or the lighthouse. So as they, in some cases, catch up to us or try to, we want to raise the bar on ourselves to show the way, to show it can be done. And I'm very excited about that. I'm a former chair of the National Governors Ethanol Coalition, or the National Ethanol Coalition, Governors Ethanol Coalition, but I've just recently become the chair of the National Governors Association overall. And the governor who's in charge of the Governors Association gets to pick a topic for the year for the governors to focus on. And I have focused on securing a clean energy future. So we're going to be using the next year to promote and encourage cleaner, better alternative fuels and energy sources for our country. And I invite ACE to be part of that discussion, part of those efforts and activities through the National Governors Association. It's a tremendous audience in a very efficient, compact way to reach all of the governors across the country in one good shot in our meetings at a couple and deliberations across the year. I want to talk to you a little bit, though, about not just the past here in Minnesota, but the future. And you know this better than anybody, but I think it's helpful to step back and remind ourselves why we are doing this. Because there are people who are kind of know-it-alls or pseudoscientists or graduates from the National Academy of It Can't Be Done, who continue to be critics, who continue to question, who continue to be skeptics. And I just want to give you my thoughts about some responses to them. First of all, we have a nation, as everyone in this room I suspect and trust believes, that is dangerously and unduly addicted to foreign sources of energy. We get 65% of our oil or thereabouts now from foreign sources, and that's going up. Now, knowing what you know about Chavez, knowing what we know about Putin, knowing what we know about the leaders in the Middle East, it is not good for our country as a matter of national security to have that much of our country's future hooked to people who don't like us or want to do us harm. On that basis alone, before we even get into the rest of the riff on the other benefits, on that basis alone, the public investment, the public encouragement towards ethanol is worth it, and then some. But there are other benefits besides. We also have an economy that is certainly now global and interdependent. But we don't want to ride the roller coaster of international oil prices. We want to diversify. We want to have more control of that here. We want to not be susceptible, not just from a national security standpoint, but economically, to have that much of our economy hooked to those unreliable and unstable sources as well. Number three, there's great concern about our environment. We want to look to fuel sources that are sustainable, that are renewable, that burn cleaner. Ethanol clearly does all of that. Number four, we are striving as a nation, we're striving as respective states to have more modern, more aggressive rural economic development policies, because you and I both know that if people don't have access to a job or a good economic opportunity, they're not going to stay. And there's great value to community, there's great value to our states, there's great value to the nation in stabilizing and regrowing rural America. One, the best way to do that is to encourage capital investment back into rural America, make sure that we have an agricultural economy that's vibrant, but also have an agricultural plus economy that offers other kinds of jobs and opportunities related to agriculture and otherwise. But think of the ethanol plant, massive, significant capital investment coming back to rural America, state-of-the-art cutting-edge technology in a growth industry that's not likely to decline but to go up, a high-paying, good-paying, high-tech, forward-looking jobs. That's a good thing. And lastly, and importantly, is the benefit to our farmers and the ability it gives to give them a value-added opportunity. We don't want our farmers susceptible to only growing commodities and offering the commodities to the market in a way that makes them so susceptible to some of the trends we've seen in the past. Here we have an opportunity for them to not only grow and sell commodities, but to create an additional market demands for the commodity, and perhaps in many cases be part of the profit side of processing and adding value to the commodity. So it is a fivefold win on national security, on economic stability, on rural economic development, on environment policy, and importantly, on agriculture and farm policy as well. So it's a terrific, terrific proposition for all of those reasons. And do not be bashful or discouraged or push back on your heels when you hear these pseudoscientists and critics. Please continue to be passionate defenders and advocates, not only for what we have, but what's coming in the future. And I applaud your efforts. And I know ACE does that day in and day out. Now, as we look to the future in Minnesota, I just signed a next-generation energy plan that has many, many different components relating to ethanol and biodiesel and wind and biomass and biogas. And we just adopted a standard that 25% of all of our energy in Minnesota is going to come from renewable sources by the year 2025. We're reducing our fossil fuel use by 15% by the year 2015 and much, much more. But it's a very aggressive package that we're proud of. But it also starts to speak about what can we do with corn ethanol or in addition to corn ethanol to boost the ethanol industry in the United States. Now, you know that, and I know that 20 or 30 years from now, if we're lucky enough to be here, we will look back on the current state of technology, on the current methods and practices for processing ethanol, and probably kind of smile and say it was quaint, you know, back then. It was, a Model T or some sort of forerunner to what's coming. And that's the nature of technology. It's the nature of processing products and the like. So we're moving towards trying to find a future where corn-based ethanol is always present, but we also make the process more efficient, and then we also open the door to other fuel sources for these plants. And it's probably inevitable, but we want to make sure that we are investing in that future now so we can clearly see it and begin to craft policies that not only sustain and grow the corn-based ethanol industry, but sustain and grow the ethanol movement more broadly. One of the challenges we have around the country in terms of acceptance with other governors, if you're not from the Corn Belt, is you go to another state that might be Georgia or Alabama and say, you know, we want you to get on this ethanol thing and mandate your gasoline to have ethanol. And some of these governors give you kind of a cockeyed look and say, well, you know, Mr. Pawlenty, I appreciate all that, but we don't grow a lot of corn here. What's in it for us? So we want to start swinging the door open to others, I think, and give them a proposition where they can be part of the movement as well. So you all know the next phase is cellulosic. There are smaller scale plants online and coming online. Nobody has yet, commercially scaled this proposition. Most of the experts say it's, 5 to 15 years away or somewhere in that range. And there's lots of talk about switchgrass and fast-growing woods and municipal waste. There's lots of talk about taking corn stalks or other agricultural byproducts and using it in cellulosic technology. There's talk about breaking down the process so that maybe you have staging areas before you ship the ultimate fuel source or rough processing before you ship the ultimate fuel source to larger collection plants and the like. But rather than have this future dumped on us, let's go out and invent it ourselves. I mean, some of you will remember Peter Drucker, who was this great organizational and management guru, strategic thinker. He unfortunately passed away about a year and a half ago at the age of 95. But many organizational leaders think he was one of the most profound strategic thinkers of our time. And he said this about the future. He said, the things that got us here will not get us there. That if you try to hang on to the present in its current form in a rapidly, profoundly changing world, you will be left behind. That you need to keep up with respect to technology, changing trends, and the like. And then he also said, the best way to predict the future is to go out and invent it yourself. That spirit, that comment, is in the tradition of the pioneers who brought us the ethanol industry in the first place. They saw a different future. They envisioned a better future. They envisioned how they could keep farmers at the center of the discussion and producers at the center of the discussion. And then they went out and invented it and pursued it and demonstrated it themselves. They took control of their own future, their own destiny. So when you think about the value of ACE and the ability to aggregate the interests, to aggregate the support for research, to aggregate the best practices, to aggregate the data, to aggregate the advocacy at Congress and in the halls of the respective states, that's why an organization like this has such tremendous value. It helps shape and take control of your own future with those ends in mind. So I want to thank ACE for that. And then lastly, I want to just share a perspective about public policy overall. There's three stages to it that I often observe in these discussions with new ideas. The first stage is, that'll never work. The second stage is, that'll cost too much. And the third stage is, hey, I thought it was a good idea the whole time. So you have heard about and read about the tipping point in public discussion and politics and culture. There's a book out, I think, called The Tipping Point. We have reached a tipping point in the United States of America on energy policy. As usual, the public is way ahead of the politicians on this. They're way ahead. They accept it. They know it. They like it. And now the policymakers are catching up. And when you see the oil companies and the car companies trying to trip over themselves to be for renewable energy and energy conservation and alternative energy, then you know we've got their attention, right? And that's what they're trying to do. And so there is a tipping point here. There's a lot of running room in terms of public support. There's a lot of running room in terms of the public policymakers' support. And we can seize the moment and take this even further as a team. And I will close with one last story, and that is a true story of Michael Jordan, as I'm told. You'll remember him as the greatest basketball player to ever play the game, MJ. And in one game during the peak of his career, he scored 56 points by himself. And the coach of the Chicago Bulls was, of course, appreciative of this performance and wanted to give the crowd a chance to give MJ an ovation. So during one of the breaks, with about a minute left to go in the game, they asked MJ to come out of the game. He walked off the court, and the crowd gave him this deserved ovation for his spectacular 56-point performance. But into the game goes this rookie who had never played in the NBA before. And so he goes into the game, and believe it or not, he gets the ball with just seconds left to go. He tries to shoot, but he gets fouled in the process, doesn't make the basket. But he gets to go to the free throw line and try for two baskets, two free throws. And so he does. He makes one and he misses one, so he gets 1 point. The buzzer goes off. The game ends. Everybody goes into the locker rooms. The press is understandably hovering around Michael Jordan with his spectacular performance and want to know about that. But one enterprising reporter kind of drifts off over to this rookie who's sitting by himself in the locker room. And the reporter says, hey, you know, this was your first NBA game. You know, what did it mean to you? What did the experience mean to you? What should we take from it? And the rookie looked up and said, you know, I think tonight should be forever remembered as the night that Michael Jordan and I together scored 57 points. That is a story about teamwork. It's a story about everybody doing their part It's a story about not worrying about, you know, who gets the credit in these things. But we can do great things, great, great things for the world and for the nation, for our rural communities, for our environment. And Margaret Mead said, never doubt the ability of a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens to change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. It is not an overstatement to say that a few pioneering farmers with a vision for a better, cleaner energy and environmental and agriculture future have changed the world. And now it's our job to take that baton from them and run with it for the next generation and raise the bar on ourselves. And I want to thank you for being leaders and advocates for this great cause. Thank you very much.